Glimpses of Bengal, excerpt by Rabindranath Tagore. Shahzadpur, June, 1891. From the bank to which the boat is tied, a kind of scent rises out of the grass, and the heat of the ground, given off in gasps, actually touches my body. I feel that the warm, living earth is breathing upon me, and that she also must feel my breath. The young shoots of rice are waving in the breeze, and the ducks are in turn thrusting their heads beneath the water and preening their feathers. There is no sound save the faint, mournful creaking of the gangway against the boat as she imperceptibly swings to and fro in the current. Not far off, there is a ferry. A motley crowd has assembled under the banyan tree, awaiting the boat's return. And as soon as it arrives, they eagerly scramble in. I enjoy watching this for hours together. It is market day in the village on the other bank. That is why the ferry is so busy. Some carry bundles of hay, some baskets, some sacks. Some are going to the market, others coming from it. Thus, in this silent noonday, the stream of human activity slowly flows across the river between two villages. I sat wondering, why is there always this deep shade of melancholy over the fields, riverbanks, the sky, and the sunshine of our country? And I came to the conclusion that it is because with us, nature is obviously the more important thing. The sky is free, the fields limitless, and the sun merges them into one blazing whole. In the midst of this, man seems so trivial. He comes and goes like the ferry boat, from this shore to the other. The babbling hum of his talk, the fitful echo of his song is heard. The slight movement of his pursuit of his own petty desires is seen in the world's marketplaces. But how feeble, how temporary, how tragically meaningless it all seems amidst the immense aloofness of the universe. The contrast between the beautiful, broad, unalloyed peace of nature, calm, passive, silent, unfathomable, and our own everyday worries, paltry, sorrow-laden, strife-tormented, puts me beside myself as I keep staring at the hazy, distant, blue line of trees which fringe the fields across the river. Where nature is ever hidden and cowers under mist and cloud, snow and darkness, there man feels himself master. He regards his desires, his works, as permanent. He wants to perpetuate them. He looks towards posterity. He raises monuments. He writes biographies. He even goes the length of erecting tombstones over the dead. So busy is he that he has not time to consider how many monuments crumble, how often names are forgotten. Shalida, 3rd July, 1893. All last night, the wind howled like a stray dog, and the rain still pours on without a break. The water from the fields is rushing in numberless, purling streams to the river. The dripping ryots are crossing the river in the ferry boat, some with their bamboo hat, others with yam leaves held over their heads. Big cargo boats are gliding along, the boatman sitting drenched at his helm, the crew straining at the tow ropes through the rain. The birds remain gloomily confined to their nests, but the sons of men fare forth, for in spite of the weather, the world's work must go on. Two cowherd lads are grazing their cattle just in front of my boat. The cows are munching away with great gusto, their noses plunged into the lush grass, their tails incessantly busy flicking off the flies. The raindrops and the sticks of the cowherd boys fall on their backs with the same unreasonable persistency, and they bear both with equally uncritical resignation. Steadily going on with their munch, 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 these cows have such mild, affectionate, mournful eyes. The river is rising daily. What I could see yesterday only from the upper deck, I can now see from my cabin windows. Every morning, I awake to find my field of vision growing larger. Not long since, only the treetops near those distant villages used to appear like dark green clouds. Today, the whole of the wood is visible. Land and water are gradually approaching each other like two bashful lovers. The limit of their shyness has nearly been reached. Their arms will soon be round each other's necks. I shall enjoy my trip along this brimful river at the height of the rains. I am fidgeting to give the order to cast. Patisar, 30th March, 1894. Sometimes, when I realize that life's journey is long and that the sorrows to be encountered are many and inevitable, a supreme effort is required to keep up my strength of mind. Some evenings, as I sit alone staring at the flame of the lamp on the table, I vow I will live as a brave man should, unmoved, silent, uncomplaining. The resolve puffs me up, and for the moment I mistake myself for a very, very brave person indeed. But as soon as the thorns on the road worry my feet, I writhe and begin to feel serious misgivings as to the future. The path of life again seems long, and my strength inadequate. But this last conclusion cannot be the true one, for it is these petty thorns which are the most difficult to bear. The household of the mind is a thrifty one, and only so much is spent as is necessary. There is no squandering on trifles, and its wealth of strength is saved up with miserly strictness to meet the really big calamities. So any amount of weeping and wailing over the lesser griefs fails to evoke a charitable response. But when sorrow is deepest, there is no stint of effort. Then the surface crust is pierced, and consolation wells up, and all the forces of patience and courage are banded together to do their duty. Thus, great suffering brings with it the power of great endurance. One side of man's nature has the desire for pleasure. There is another side which desires self-sacrifice. When the former meets with disappointment, the latter gains strength, and on its thus finding fuller scope, a grand enthusiasm fills the soul. So while we are cowards before petty troubles, great sorrows make us brave by rousing our truer manhood. And in these, therefore, there is a joy. It is not an empty paradox to say that there is joy in sorrow, just as, on the other hand, it is true that there is a dissatisfaction in pleasure. It is not difficult to understand why this should be so.